Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Human-caused climate change is creating heat waves of increasing intensity, duration, and frequency that disproportionately affect underserved communities of color. Today, we talk with Portland State University Professor Vivek Chandas about how redlining, the historical practice of refusing home loans or insurance to whole neighborhoods based on a racially motivated perception of safety for investment, has created neighborhoods that are the most vulnerable to the dangers of heat domes and other climatic anomalies, such as what we saw last summer. Vivek, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. It's great to be here.
Well, the last time that we talked, you had been traveling around the city during those very hot days at the end of June of last year, measuring the temperature of the air and sidewalks, and discovering that there were great disparities between the temperatures you measured in downtown Portland and in some of the upper middle class neighborhoods in Portland and out in Lentz, for one, and I guess some other communities in the outlying parts of the city. So I wondered if we could just review a little bit about what you discovered and that experience, and then we'll talk about how these disparities of, should we call it heat equity, have been perhaps created by some of the historical racially motivated zoning.
Yeah, thanks, Barbara. I'd love to. You know, we've been spending a great deal of time trying to understand how we're designing our cities and how those designs translate to potential impacts from a warmer planet. And so part of that is just gathering lots of empirical evidence. And we've been measuring temperature for at least about 15 years now in cities all around the country. And one of the things about temperature is that it's a really interesting metric for assessing various things about where you can actually see differences in the built environment, meaning the buildings, the trees, the sidewalks, the roads, and how those things can amplify temperatures or in other ways actually reduce temperatures. And when we go out, and the wonderful, also wonderful thing about temperature is that it's scalable. Like, you can get a temperature of this individual bedroom that you might go to sleep in, or you can get a temperature reading for the entire city or metro region, and we can even get a temperature for the entire planet. And so it really scales well. And we've been going out and measuring air temperature, surface temperatures, and just getting a sense for what does it mean to use temperature as an indicator for equity, indicator for exposure to increasingly hot neighborhoods, as we're seeing with development practices happening around the city. And what is that? How does that translate to the health and well-being of community members, some of whom may not have the adequate resources to cope with those hotter temperatures? And so on that heat dome event, I found it to be a great way to get my son, frankly, away from his video game and go out and collect temperatures with him all around the city. We went to about 11 different places, starting out in southeast and inner industrial area, and then circling around through Hawthorne District, going out to Lentz, circling up to Rockwood, and down northeast into the northwest area. And so collecting those temperatures, both air temperature and surface temperature, gave us a real reading of how even in one day we could have a temperature difference of roughly 25 degrees across one city, one mid-sized city in the United States. And that temperature difference of 25 degrees is the ambient, meaning the outside temperature. If you're in a building that's three or four stories tall, that heat can rise. If you don't have access to operable windows, or if you don't have access to AC, that can be upwards of 130, 140 degrees, as we've been able to measure in some apartment buildings around the city at the same time.
So what relationship do you see between the heat discrepancies that you were measuring last summer and some historic practices that may have created the neighborhoods that are so vulnerable to the ravages of heat?
Yeah, one of the things that's been super interesting for our work is the empirical evidence has been mounting, and we're seeing this consistent pattern, not just in Portland, though all around the country, where we're seeing those neighborhoods that were lower income, black majority neighborhoods, neighborhoods that have historically been disinvested in over decades, having some of the hottest temperatures. And I was scratching my head for a good 3 or 4 years asking myself, like, what is that pattern? Where is it coming from? And the part of science is about trying to describe why those patterns exist. And so I'd ask my colleagues, and they'd often say, well, you know, it's the luxury effect. It's wealthy folks can plant trees, they can curate their yards, they can really go about taking care of their local environment, thereby cooling and potentially finding ways to mitigate some of that heat. And that was really unsatisfying to me because it was really about the individual choice. And I've consistently seen in other environmental questions that I've asked much more systemic things that are at play. And so one of the systemic things that had been at play that we wanted to dig into a little bit more closely was how neighborhoods were created in the way that they were. And so one obvious place to look was in the 1930s, when we were coming out of the Great Depression in the United States and we were finding ways to kind of get the country back with its economic power engine and the economy really staggering, there was an attempt to really organize neighborhoods within cities into four different grades. And this grade was A, B, C, and D. And this was largely done to be able to get private and federal lending agencies to encourage home ownership. So it was the idea that people would go about identifying a neighborhood as ideal for lending a mortgage and other neighborhoods that were not ideal for lending a mortgage.
Can you mention the description for each one of those categories?
Yeah, right. If you look at the actual language that was presented in some of the maps that were created, there were A was considered, quote, best. That was the green-lined areas of cities, right? So those were neighborhoods that were wealthy, often white-majority neighborhoods, white racial-majority neighborhoods. And then there was B, which was considered still desirable. That's the official language of the Homeowners Loan Corporation and the Federal Housing Administration, both of whom administered these federal codified policies that were legally backed. And so the C neighborhoods, so A, B, C neighborhoods, were considered definitely declining in the language. And then D neighborhoods were considered, quote, hazardous. And this is where we get into some really interesting kind of really interesting questions about what went into the description of these neighborhoods. And when you I'd encourage listeners to go to a great website called Mapping Inequality at the University of Richmond, and where you can go to these maps and you can actually see digitized versions of what official language was in those documents about why specific neighborhoods were considered hazardous versus the best in cities all around the country. And that's where we start getting to questions of how did that play into current day temperatures?
Well, actually, before you get there, I want to talk a little bit about why were these neighborhoods considered hazardous? Because I'm looking at the map of Portland that was from the mid-30s. It was interesting. All of downtown Portland was redlined, and most of inner southeast was redlined, and of course, north and northeast Portland were redlined.
Right. And you can go to this Mapping Inequality website, look at Portland, look at the percentage of each of the look at the percentage of each of these grades that were placed, as well as going into individual roads and seeing if they were. So the parts of Portland that were redlined, remember, this is back in the 1930s. And so what the population in the 1930s was three-quarters of, at least what the documents would reveal, three-quarters of African-American black communities lived in the Albina district, which was considered, quote, the slum district of Portland back in the 1930s when these maps were being created. They were immigrant communities in Northwest Portland, Old Town, Chinatown area, as well as owning businesses all through various parts of downtown, which was also considered redlined at the time. Then there were places that were right along MLK and a lot of what you see, Alberta, Mississippi, again, Albina, and then parts of inner, close and southeast Portland, as well as areas just north of Powell Boulevard, south of Hawthorne Boulevard, Red Line. And then the large parts of southeast Portland, northeast Portland, especially along Columbia Boulevard, Lombard Boulevard, were largely yellow lined. So those red and yellows were really places where not much investments were being placed, whether through federal home-backed loans or through city policies. Because if you remember, in the 1920s and 30s, Portland was very connected to the Ku Klux Klan. There was a lot of white supremacy notions that were public, and mayors and city attorneys, sheriff's office, police were all very in line with the KKK here, local chapters in Portland. And so that was a very clear connection to these neighborhoods then being segregated. And what we're starting to see is some of that being revealed in some of the maps we're creating today.
Another interesting community that's mentioned in that same Bureau of Planning and Sustainability report that I was looking at that showed the red line map was South Portland, which we know also is Lear Hill, which was demolished in the 60s. And that neighborhood was traditionally Italian, Black, and Jewish. Mm-hmm. And so the Black part, okay, that's definitely falls into the redlining bigotry. But what about the Italians and the Jews?
Yeah, it was anybody who wasn't considered white, Caucasian, were implicated in this particular yellow lining or redlining process. I'll read some official language from the redlining document for the city of Portland, if I can make this out. It's a very small print, and I'm reading it on my phone here. But it essentially says, nor shall the same, meaning single-family residential housing, that's what this is referring to, nor shall the same of any part thereof be in any manner used or occupied by Chinese, Japanese, or Negroes, except that persons of said races may be employed by servants of residents. And so that's the kind of language that's used, whether it's China, in this case, they're specifically talking about Chinese, Japanese, or Negroes, but there's plenty of other language in this that talks about Italians, that talks about Russians, that talks about Orientals generally. So anybody who was outside of that specific white race were considered a immigrant or a person of color, and therefore was those neighborhoods were designated as C or D neighborhoods from the 1930s through the 1960s.
Well, I also find it interesting that the largest Jewish community, the Eastern European Jews, were settled in Lair Hill. Now, the German Jews who'd come over in the 19th century were over in Northwest Portland in a blue or green line neighborhood. So I'm curious about do you see that there was also anti-Semitism that was involved in some of this redlining?
Oh, absolutely. It's really very clear when you see the language that's written, when you look at Chicago, when you look at New York, when you look at Brooklyn, and you go just perusing these different documents from different parts of the country, the systematic racism that was embedded into these documents is like nothing I have seen in other official federal documents. And this was really something that was very pernicious and something that was legal. I mean, it was really legal. You would see it in newspaper clippings, when you would see in Minneapolis, for example, like this particular neighborhood would have a racial covenant associated to it where no person of color could move into the neighborhood. And if someone did try to move into the neighborhood, legal action could be taken against that person or family. And so it was very strongly prosecuted as well. And so that's something that makes any form of kind of integration very challenging during that time.
When you listen to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KFRP Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland State University Professor Vivek Chandas about how redlining has created neighborhoods that are the most vulnerable to the dangers of heat events. So you're describing how widespread this redlining was, and that these maps were made for, I forget how many cities around the country.
Over 200.
I'm currently reading this really amazing book by Isabel Wilkerson called The Warmth of Other Suns. And one of the things that really stands out is how when the Blacks migrated from the South to the North, to Chicago, to the Northeast, to California, primarily to Oakland and Richmond and L.A., that they discovered that there were all kinds of insidious barriers to them in the North, in the Northeast, in the Great Lakes region, and in the West Coast. Is redlining basically a phenomenon of those regions where the Great Migration took Black Southerners, or is it spread further than that around the country?
Keep in mind, like the existence of race-based policies in the U.S. is as old as the U.S. And so in many cases, it's hard. Redlining is just one byproduct or an example of many of these policies that have played out. So I don't think that redlining necessarily emerged out of the Great Migration. I don't think there's much that we could point to directly in that historically, though I could be probably questioned on that. Nevertheless, I think what we have is a means with redlining. It's a means of the federal government being able to codify and structure a set of rules, policies, programs that would actively reduce the likelihood of neighborhoods being integrated with multiple races, multiple incomes, and really thinking about what we've tried to do here is inclusionary zoning in the Portland metro region. And so that really allows a greater deal of integration of multiple of different backgrounds, people from different races, to actually live in and around a in a neighborhood, which wasn't possible from the 1930s until the Fair Housing Act of the 1960s, and a lot of civil rights movements in the 60s officially banned redlining and race-based housing policies. Though those racial covenants and other forms of race-based planning and zoning still exist today.
I find it interesting that this was instituted during the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration. One kind of thing that's popping to my head is one of the people in The Warmth of Other Suns, the woman who immigrated to Chicago, and shortly after she immigrated, there was the first election for Roosevelt, and it was the first time she could vote, which was a really big deal, because, of course, in the South, in Mississippi, where she was from, blacks couldn't vote. And so she voted for Roosevelt. She was really excited about Roosevelt. And they named their first daughter that was born in Chicago Eleanor. So this is the experience that blacks wanted to have of Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. However, it seems that some of the worst codification of racism actually came under the Roosevelt administration. And I wonder, do you have any understanding of how that all played out?
Oh, that's above my pay grade. That is a really interesting history there, and I'd love to dig into it a little bit more, but I would be overstepping if I tried to delve into that particular question.
I do think that they were probably right in naming their daughter Eleanor, but Eleanor Roosevelt, I think, really understood racism and was really fighting against it, but her husband was a little bit too much of a politician to do it. To me, that really shows just the, as you were describing a little bit earlier, that basically the racist undertones and overtones and structure that this country is based on. And you mentioned that the Fair Housing Act in 1968 addressed that, but how much effect did that really have on changing the actual practices?
Yeah, it's a really interesting, complicated question to think about the role that policy plays in terms of broader societal perceptions of race, broader societal ways in which we are able to internalize these implicit biases that we may have because of the fact that we're human and that we really are a species that distinguishes based on visual characteristics often. And so I think the part of that question that I'd really get into is the fact that when you don't have a legal and kind of prosecutable system that would prevent somebody from being able to move into any neighborhood they wanted, then you're really into then you're really able to explore at the local level many more policies that might actually allow for people of different backgrounds, income, race, etc., to be living in the same proximity to one another. And that was, again, if you go back to folks who were talking about public spaces in the early 1900s, they were talking about parks being places where people of all different backgrounds would come together and be able to learn from each other and play together, whether it be baseball or other recreation. And so the policies that were set up to try to reduce it, I think, are a direct and enforceable means to be able to ensure that we do have an equitable, just, and very a system that allows people to live where they choose to live and where they can live. Yet at the same time, those implicit biases that humans have often are still present, and they still confer many challenges in neighborhoods, as many of us have experienced growing up in a predominantly white part of Northern California. I mean, I can say that I had very direct experiences with racial violence towards me, whether it's be microaggressions or more severe. And in traveling around different parts of the world, I've experienced very similar experiences just because of the color of my skin. So it's something that, while we may put it official in policy, it's really something that can be much more insidious in terms of our individual experiences that we all still have today. And the challenge of race in America is nothing new, for sure.
Well, I was very surprised when I moved to Portland in 1971, first of all, that it was such a white city. And I was especially surprised that it seemed like all the blacks were really ghettoized in North and Northeast Portland. And I've noticed over the many years that I've lived here that you see much more diversity on the streets of Portland. There's now people of color downtown. well, if people were going downtown these days, but up until 2020, they were downtown. And in Forest Park, which is one place, the first time I saw a black person in Forest Park, I was so happy and so amazed, and mostly amazed at how long it had taken for that to happen. So I wonder if this is all basically a result of the kind of racism that was instituted by the redlining in the 1930s.
Yeah, possibly so. I mean, when you talk about experiences that you have of seeing people of color in Forest Park and black person in Forest Park, for example, it brings up so many other questions of like how specific spaces have been largely kind of segregated, not just neighborhoods, but public spaces have been segregated, where folks who are from other parts of the world, folks who have more pigmentation on their skin, would not feel welcome in certain places, not only because they stand out, and something I've had in my world of environmental sciences as being one of the only, in some cases, or one of the few people of color in the curriculum, in the research side, one starts to feel like out of place and doesn't, it's very hard to actually feel welcomed in a public park that's, you don't see anybody like yourself. You often see signage, for example, that's not in different languages that you can't really interpret if you're a person coming from another part of the world who doesn't have English fluency. And so the notion of creating welcoming spaces and thriving, verdant spaces for communities to be able to go and feel comfortable and feel safe, I think is something that our planning agencies have been woefully inadequate in terms of their ability to really center those voices and those experiences. And so now we're starting to see a bit more of that occurring. And my world of thinking about climate change is the entry point of how do we start to actually have those conversations in terms of our more intense summers, in terms of heat, our greater likelihood of rain or impacts from precipitation and those kinds of natural disasters in relation to what we've done with our planning practices in the past.
Well, I found this interesting map online, which is, I think, a superimposition of a redlining map with a heat island map. Is that, and I think it was Portland. Is that something that your group was responsible for?
Yes, it probably was. On a Sunday afternoon, I probably put that map together.
So let's describe what that map shows.
Yeah, so what we did was almost 2 years ago. This study has been about 5 years in the making, and we published this 2 years ago, and many other studies are coming out corroborating some of these findings. Is arguably that one of the first studies to take 108 neighborhoods across, 108 cities across the country. We used these redlining maps, and we overlaid onto those redlining maps just surface temperatures derived from satellite imagery. So we could take these robots flying in space, these satellites, they take images of the Earth, and what they take is essentially what's called, technically speaking, it's this long-wave radiation that comes off of the surface once the sun hits it. And you can measure how hot a neighborhood is, how hot a street is. It's very granular, meaning very detailed data. And so we compared 108 cities based on these A, B, C, and D grades, as we were talking about earlier. And we found that on average across these 108 cities, it's about a 5-degree Fahrenheit difference between the A grade and the D grade of neighborhoods that were graded as such. And so that got me finally a little more satisfaction because I was starting to see this pattern emerge. And of the 108 cities that emerged, one of the most interesting patterns was that Portland, Denver, Minneapolis were the top three cities of that study, where Portland's temperature differential between those A-grade neighborhoods, like we were talking about in terms of Eastmoreland or Laurelhurst or Hollywood, some of the Goose Hollow West Side neighborhoods, and Albina, Old Town, Chinatown, and the other neighborhoods, the red line neighborhoods we're talking about, was upwards of 13 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's very consistent with the measurements we've been going out and taking in different parts of the city as well.
So what does that say about this long legacy of having been redlined in the 1930s, and bearing the brunt of the excessive heat that we're experiencing now as a result of climate change?
Yeah, I'll keep this short because this is a whole class, a whole university class, in fact. But really, if you think about it from the 1930s to the 60s, what was happening during that time? We had a lot of public housing starting to emerge. We had a lot of infrastructure projects. America is really infatuated with large infrastructure projects. And so one of the things that happened in the 50s after World War II is huge freeways started being laid down by Eisenhower, and the interstate highway system was created. And guess which neighborhoods those large freeways went in. They went into neighborhoods that were considered, quote, from a cost-benefit analysis, the lowest rent land neighborhoods. And by design, when you're disinvesting in a neighborhood by not giving mortgages, by not putting in green spaces, et cetera, into those neighborhoods, they are going to be there are going to be lower land rent values. And as a result, the freeways went there, the industrial facilities went to these adjacent to these neighborhoods that were redlined or yellow lined. The public housing projects went into these. So all these are very dense infrastructure, right? You think about asphalt. That absorbs a tremendous amount of heat from the sun. It just retains it, and that dense material that building structures are made of, roads are made of, that holds on to that heat when it's directly exposed to it. And as a result, that heat amplifies. And just as that dense material is trying to let go of all that heat, that thermal capacity that it gains, the sun comes up again. It's trying to cool off at night, doesn't get it all the heat out, so the sun comes up again, bakes it in again. And so what you end up getting is these large infrastructure projects going in, and as a result, this heat kind of accumulating there, a lot of what technically we call impervious surface, that's the stuff where basically water cannot infiltrate down. And so it, not only did we see that, but we published another study a couple of years earlier that showed the heat and flooding that was happening were also in those redline neighborhoods. And that's in large part because none of the water can infiltrate down. It collects and then starts to pool and then creates potential flooding problems. So the heat in the summer, the flooding in the winter starts to really kind of play out when you see these largely sealed up surfaces in some neighborhoods versus others.
When you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KFRP, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland State University Professor Vivek Chandes about how redlining has created neighborhoods that are the most vulnerable to the dangers of heat events. Well, you turn me on to this page that the city of Portland has put out that is like examining a lot of the things that we're talking about, and it was examining the historic racist zoning practices and investment practices in Portland. And they made all kinds of very strong remarks, including talking about the removal of a community of old Eastern European Jews to build the South Portland Auditorium District in the late 60s. I'm wondering if you feel like the city, besides putting out this webpage, has done anything to really redress some of these serious problems.
It's a major achievement for a city to own up to its historical practices. I'd start there. There are I have the privilege of being able to talk to planners all around the country and asking them about some of the questions we're talking about today. And in some cases, I've talked to planners who are saying, yeah, we know redlining happened, but we don't know where any of those maps went. They just disappeared. And there's other places saying, yeah, that's all good and plenty, but we got economic growth to think about because we're a city whose budget is cratering, and so we can't really think about that. And so I've heard the whole kind of set of possible explanations for this, and I will really recognize the fact that that Portland in September 2019 came out with this report called Historical Context of Racist Planning, a history of how planning segregated Portland. And just to identify those case studies, to go into the mapping, to go into describing what was happening in the area is a major first step. It's the recognition of this, which, you know, in many cases it'll validate the reality for a lot of African-American, Black families, immigrant families, people of color, lower-income families. And yet it'll challenge a lot of other communities who have thought that it's because of their merit, their own kind of tenacity, their own abilities, they were able to secure this land and get this house and live in the way they did. And so it really challenges a lot of our notions. In terms of the question, more specifically, what is being done? I think that's an ongoing question. What can be done? Questions of anti-displacement policies, for example, and trying to think about neighborhoods that are gentrifying a great deal, because many of those neighborhoods that were redlined in the past, developers have been speculating on those for decades and now are hotspots for rapid development. Think about Williams Avenue. Think about Albina, Mississippi, Alberta. classic examples of where massive amounts of large investment projects, development projects have been going in. And from what I can tell, a lot of these are not the types of housing, the types of development that is necessarily affordable. And so we're seeing this kind of shift of what's happening in terms of the infrastructure going into these neighborhoods. And yet we're also trying to reckon with the fact that these are areas that are displaced. These are areas that are getting massive amounts of displacement. And a recent 2020 analysis that we did found that the neighborhoods that are growing the fastest in terms of non-white populations are neighborhoods in East Portland. So that's east of I-205. And that's also, those are also some of the neighborhoods, by the way, back in 2014 that we saw were the hottest neighborhoods in Portland. So as this displacement is happening, communities from Albina, Mississippi, other historically redline neighborhoods are moving and being displaced into East Portland. We're seeing those neighborhoods get a lot more infrastructure go in, amplifying temperatures even more, and potentially exposing communities that that may not be able to cope with the hotter temperatures to greater levels of extreme heat. And during the heat dome event in 2021, that's where we saw the greatest number of deaths happen in the Portland area, was in East Portland. Many of the neighborhoods we, by the way, had identified back in 2014 and even 2009 in terms of potential vulnerability. So what is Portland doing? It's a tough question. I think it's happening in incremental progress, which in my opinion, as well as my colleagues, hardly enough. And so thinking about multifamily residential zoning, what can we do to reduce the amplification of temperature? We collaborated with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to model computational models to look at how different forms of multifamily residential design will mitigate temperatures, and did find that there are types of multifamily residential that will actually keep temperatures upwards of 9 degrees cooler if we were to design in with a lot more green infrastructure, for example, with street trees, with green roofs, with lighter colors, with separation of development, so you get some convective wind currents to move through, cooling temperatures. And those were brought into a policy. Some of those were brought into a policy called Better Housing by Design, which was a multifamily residential rezoning policy. So it's happening, though for some of us, happening too slow, given the fact that 2021 was the fourth hottest year on record for in U.S. history.
Well, the other concern that a lot of people are raising has to do with the kinds of development that's still going on the edges of the original redline communities where people still live in North Portland and in Linton, which is another community that's really overlooked. And it has a lot to do with the Portland Harbor and the kind of toxic fossil fuel-oriented development that's been going on there since World War II. I wonder if are you in conversations at all with the city about the impact that basically doing nothing about, for instance, the critical energy infrastructure hub, which is all that vast array of tank farms that runs along Highway 30 all the way to Sobey Island, because those seem to be another outgrowth of the redlining.
Yeah, our land use policies have, it's so interesting. Portland has got a history of removing freeways from along the waterfront, right? Like Tomacall Park, et cetera, are replacements of what used to be freeways in that location. And there is a history of removal of infrastructure and replacement, though the fossil fuel infrastructure and the ecosystem that is directly implicated in supporting it is so vast and so powerful that, you know, things, achievements that have been done recently, including some of that you've brought on this show, are really kind of tributes to what we can see is possible. The fact that our ability to have conversations with the city about that particular type of land use has been really challenging because heavy industrial land use, for example, is completely, at this point, waived from tree requirements, green infrastructure requirements. And so the way the models are set up is every loss of square foot of industrial development is a loss of jobs. And that very linear type of thinking just really flies in the face of the fact that we can think a bit more creatively about how we can keep industrial facilities in place while also finding ways to cool the areas adjacent to it or even within those facilities. And that conversation has not been happening very much. And so I'd love to see those conversations kind of get into specific designs of what could industrial and climate mitigation and the fossil fuel industry more generally do to reduce the potential impacts from that type of land use on human health and well-being in adjacent communities.
Well, ironically, the group that I've been working with has found that one of the obstacles to, for instance, getting trees planted in the industrial port area in north and northeast Portland and northwest Portland is the Goal 9 of the Oregon Land Use Laws, which basically requires that every city must have an adequate supply of industrial land. And the way that Bob Salinger, the Portland Audubon Society, describes it is that the Portland Harbor and the industries are the ones that are interviewed by the group that the city's planning commission uses to assess how much industrial land there is. And they're always saying that they need more. And so then it's time to open up more park space, more open space. For a long time, West Hayden Island was targeted as being another industrial site. And that there's not a whole lot of honest looking at how much industrial land in that area is lying empty right now. And then another concern is that some of the industrial land, particularly, I think it was Terminal 1, was transformed into condos and mixed-use development. So that's not industry. So what you're doing is that the city is selling its industrial land at a profit to developers and then needing to find more land to be industrial. So the thing that's very frustrating is that the economic opportunity assessment that is done every 5 years or so, which would assess how much industrial land there is, has been such a slanted, untransparent process. And so this group that I'm working with is working to make it more transparent. I've been talking with the city for over a year about it. And the timeline actually got pushed back a year in coming up with a final statement because of COVID and people leaving the department. So I wonder how we move on that. I mean, I'm impressed by the work that the people that I know are doing, but it still seems like the city is just dragging its heels and still doing things the way they always have.
Right. I can't speak a great deal about the, of course, the transparency, the processes are essential in being able to have accountability and direct connection between what our needs are and what the land uses look like. And I can't speak to the politics of it in much detail, but I can say that the way that many of the analyses are done for the trade-offs that we're making are relatively narrow, myopic, and often have a very kind of singular type of number associated to the output. And so having spent a lot of time modeling and looking at data sets in my career, I can see some of these kind of cost-benefit models, which got us into this, in many ways, got us into this mess in the first place, because as we were saying earlier, those freeways that went in, they were based on a particular model that planners and designers developed and consulted on to be able to put the specific freeway in that specific black neighborhood. And we're using very similar models today. Those have not changed a great deal when we're talking about land use and how we're trading off. We're putting one community at risk by supporting another community. And this goes back to the whole race-based planning that we had and kind of looking at the way that we're engaging some communities and not engaging other communities like you're expressing. If we were to, for example, bring into the model the health metrics, the impacts of air pollution, of heat, of flooding, and the associated costs of those kind of what would be called adjacent impacts or even proximate impacts, surrogate impacts, if you will, that would be a very different outcome in terms of how we're trading off and thinking about the way we're managing our city and thinking about land use. So I go back to the way we're actually even characterizing the trade-offs that we're looking at and what goes into those decisions and opening up the hood on some of those models to really see what is it that we're privileging and what is it we're leaving out.
Well, I find it a challenge looking at a city that can put out a report that you were describing that looks at the racial history of how land was allocated and zoned and developed and not developed in Portland, and also a city where the city council does a land acknowledgement before every meeting. That's all well and good, but how do we get the city to actually live up to its own standards?
Movements. Like, that's where I go. I mean, I start thinking about the incredible movements that some of us have been part of that have actually been able to, for example, question fossil fuel infrastructure in the city, for example, or for that matter, and also movements even at the micro level. I have the distinct privilege of serving as chair of the Urban Forestry Commission, and one of the things that I kept hearing is that, you know, commercial and industrial zones were exempt from the title, from the forestry code, from Title 11, which is our tree code that gives us kind of direction about what to do. And commercial and industrial were exempt from that tree code. And that was done, you know, during a time coming out of the 2000s, really 2008, 2009, and it was promulgated in 2015. As official code, and it was during a time where we were in economic recovery, and in the commercial and industrial communities were very vocal about saying we cannot have this infringe on our ability to have more land for creating these jobs that are essential. And yes, essential jobs are essential. At the same time, that exemption has now created these very hot areas of the city that are amplifying temperatures, and so the whole question of what can we do in terms of moving a city a bit more in that direction, we really pushed as a commission for not exempting commercial industrial, and we were able to get a win on that. Heavy industrial is still exempt, though that is also now our next movement that we're thinking about. How do we move in that direction? And so the short answer for me is just like, how do we create enough movement and community-based, ground-up effort to be able to question some of the existing laws that are in place that are keeping us from being able to create a healthier, more thriving region.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Portland State University Vivek Chandas about how redlining has created neighborhoods that are the most vulnerable to the dangers of heat events and what we're going to do about it. So I want you to go a little further, Vivek, in what you just said, because it sounds exciting to me. I mean, I think about the movement a number of years ago to stop Pembina from building, the nation's largest liquid propane export terminal in Portland. And that grew into the ban on future fossil fuel expansion or development of any new fossil fuel infrastructure. But then we had Zenith Energy come in and just violate that ban, which hadn't really been put into place. And I've been despairing for the last 2 years. How do you build a movement when everybody's socially isolated? I mean, you and I can barely see each other through this glass in the studio or in separate studios. And this is the kind of togetherness that we've been able to have for the last almost 2 years. On the other hand, we did see a win when we were feeling safe, when many, many people were vaccinated at the beginning of the summer, that there was a big movement to stop a permit that the city had to give to Zenith in order for them to actually go ahead and do what they want to do to ban their ability to transport oil through Portland. And the activists won, and the city refused to give that permit to Zenith. So we've seen some wins even in this time of COVID. But I wonder, how do we go further? What do we do to really get the city to act on the things that it claims it believes in?
And I think that, yeah, it's the core question right there. How do we get our municipal leaders to really respond to and listen to the voices that have been for a very long time expressing deep concerns about, whether it be in the 60s urban renewal and how that's absolutely decimating a neighborhood, or it be questions of freeway expansions like we're talking about now with ODOT and what's happening on I-5. So there are several challenges that we are directly confronting that support, in many cases, this massive car-based fossil fuel economy that we're all really kind of dependent upon. And at the same time, I'm seeing so much inspiration right now from the younger folks that I am interacting with, the folks of whether it be the Sunrise Movement, whether it be folks who are really seeing that their future that they're inheriting from this lock-in of land use, this lock-in of decimating green spaces, of segregating communities, that neighborhoods that are being locked in that way, they're seeing this as a real challenge to their future and their ability to really thrive in the future. And I think they're rising up in a way that allows us to think a bit more deeply about the system that the entire fossil fuel industry has created in our cities, and largely run by roads, largely run by cars, largely run by an economy that kind of depends on something that is a diminishing resource at this point. So I think where I'm getting a lot of inspiration is the energy behind the youth movements today. I see youth coming into our Urban Forestry Commission meetings. I'm getting emails like on a weekly basis from high school students saying, I am really upset about what I am hearing in relation to segregation and climate change. It's not a connection I've ever made before. And yet here I am spending my entire junior year of high school focusing on this project that aims to describe it and then identify ways around it. And so I guess the excitement for me is really being trying to do work that's what I like to call critical urban translational research, Kurt. And that for me is a way to be able to participate in not necessarily the front line of being in that space of standing up of right in front of a freeway expansion project, but to be able to provide the data, provide the research, provide the kind of analytics to be able to identify the relationships that people may not be seeing otherwise. And that's where this heat and housing study came. Those two were two very separate fields of study. And by kind of connecting them through looking at historic housing practices, we were able to show that there's a direct link to climate-induced impacts that we're experiencing today, almost a century later after some of these policies have been put into place. So my hope is that we'd like to participate in movements, and it takes those who are able to provide the research and the kind of depth of understanding with those that are right there with the policy analysis with and those that are pushing back. And so the movement is really multifaceted in that regard, and I think we all have to find ways to plug in where we can.
Well, almost 2 years ago, in many ways, the world and our social movements were transformed by the murder of George Floyd and the amazing social movement that grew out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating to watch every environmental organization that I'm aware of dealing with their own internal racism and dealing with how they really needed to find a way to connect meaningfully to the needs of communities of color, to the realities of racism, and whether it's in their own organization or how they deal with the outside world. How well do you think we've done since then? And how do you see that as a place, a starting point to really move forward?
Yeah. Oh, boy. That's a really challenging question, because I feel a lot of despair when I hear that question, in that it just is a recognition of how much work we have yet to do. The small world that I live in of trying to think about the relationship between our built environment and kind of a lot of the systemic oppression and racism that I see around me, I mean, I could attribute a lot of what happened in the George Floyd killing to exactly the story we're talking about today, where the neighborhoods in Minneapolis that were redlined were intentionally disinvested, where communities were not able to gain access to wealth, and where one neighborhood of the same house, Andre Perry's work out of the Brookings Institute would suggest that there are $58,000 undervalued, the same house in one redline neighborhood versus a non-redline counterpart. And those kind of assessments that I'm seeing in the world really bolster for me the fact that we need to really rethink a lot of the ways that we're making decisions. We need to rethink that the policies that have been guiding the way we're building our cities. We have a very different set of threats that are upon us, whether it be climate change, racial injustice, economic injustice, and that I think we're really trying many different ways. And the solutions that I'm seeing in some places, like the PCEF program here in Portland, tremendous way of getting money into communities that have been historically disinvested. I have the fortune of speaking to folks all around the country and sometimes world on this, and I point to the PSEF program as a truly community-led.
What's the name? What does that stand for?
Portland Clean Energy Fund, and it's a program that really is, I think, a national leader in terms of being able to bring the resources into communities that have never had them, and then start thinking about what does it mean to create a regenerative economy? What does it mean to create a just transition? What does it mean to really center those voices that have been left out of the conversation? And that materializing in a program like PSEF is such, for me, such a kind of moment of reckoning where we did something that no other city in the country had done, and now Denver and a few other cities are really thinking about this. And so I think we have a lot of work to do, though there's some real, there's some light coming through the cracks at this point, as Leonard Cohen would say.
Well, one last thing. How do you see that we can reshape our approach towards urban development and work to really rectify the inequities and the injustice that was caused by redlining? In terms of, you mentioned a few ways that buildings can be built that are going to be greener and more sustainable and more environmentally friendly. But do you have any other like overarching vision of how that could happen?
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts, and by no means able to articulate the grandness of this, but in my own modest way, I think what I would really want to point to is the idea that communities have been done to for the history of planning, urban planning. City makes a decision, they consult, maybe inform the community where this change is going to happen, and then move forward in the design, plan, and implementation. And so where we're really needing to move towards, in my read of what's happening right now, is we need to work into a two-way conversation. Just like we were talking about the transparency with industrial land use zoning, this idea is making its way into the academic literature around this notion of co-production, meaning we're co-producing knowledge together. I don't come here with knowledge about everything that's going to be good for this community, and I cannot therefore come in and say, this is going to be the best thing for you, take it. I need to be receptive enough, be listening enough, be open enough to be able to engage in an honest and direct dialogue about what it means for this community to thrive. Maybe it's not about me saying, oh my goodness, there's a lack of trees in this heat island in Portland, let's throw a bunch of trees at it. No, that's not what the co-production strategy that I would be advocating. I would say, what is it about the heat that is affecting this community? Do they experience the heat? Do they have cooling options when heat waves descend upon them? Where do they go? What might be solutions that they could identify? I really don't believe that I can, solutions for people are done best by the people who are being affected by that challenge. And so if we really are thinking about that seriously, where planning needs to go is a far deeper recognition of what it means to be in active dialogue with community-based organizations who are often in touch with the community members, with private entities, entrepreneurs who are in those communities who are trying to do good, and really finding ways to navigate some of those wicked and complex challenges that no single entity by themselves are going to be able to take on.
Well, Vivek, it's always great to talk to you. I'm really glad I've had you on Locus Focus twice this year, and I hope to have you back soon. So thanks for being on Locus Focus today.
Thanks so much, Barbara. Great to be here.
We've been talking with Portland State University Professor Vivek Chandez, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, KRFP Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. We're independent, community-supported, volunteer-powered radio. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting Community Powered Radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty about the challenges the city faces in the coming year. We'll go out with music by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. Wash your hands. Get your COVID shots. And remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.
A bottle of justice, I'll take that bottle of justice. I hear it sets you free. You can be just who you want to be. I think I'll have some of that. Now wrap it up real nice for me, please. Pass me a slice of opportunity. I'll have that slice of opportunity. I hear it fills you up, makes you shine just like summer buttercups, summer buttercups. I think I'll have some of that. Wrap it up real nice. I could act as if I just don't care. Some of that could take me anyway. In a universe that's still unknown, I'd be home. Some of that is all I'm asking for. Some of that. Nothing more. Some of that.